The 100 seasons 1 and 2 are over, but season 3 is just about to get started, and so are we here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everybody. I'm Josh Wigler, very excited about this podcast, long time coming, talking about The 100, the show on the CW, and there's really no one better in the universe, certainly in the Post Show Recaps family, and probably literally the universe, to talk about this show with than our two guests today. You know them from past Post Show Recaps podcasts. You know them from the Dropship, they're The 100 podcast. Hopefully you know it. Otherwise, you're about to find out all about it. It's AJ Mass and Joe Garfine. AJ, what's going on?
What's going on, Josh? Been a long time coming, this podcast. I know we've been wanting to get you on board the 100 train for quite some time. Finally, we're here, and I'm excited to talk about it with you.
I'm excited, too. Joe, what's going on, my friend?
Well, it is a busy, fun week. Season 3 premieres Thursday. Basically, I am a promo machine. You know me. When I love something, I want to talk about it. I want to make sure everyone else is watching it and engage in constructive conversation about it. So I appreciate you having us on because, sure, we have our own 100 podcasts, but I feel like you're one of our top recruits. And so to be able to talk about the show we all love, knowing that we all started loving Lost together, that's how we all met, I feel like this is kismet.
Yeah, I think so. So let's just set that up real quick, because I want to take like a small slice of ownership over what you guys are doing. Can I take like a tiny, tiny bit of credit?
Dude, you take the whole pie.
Just give me a slice and I'm good. I don't need the whole pie. You guys eat most of it. But I want to take one small slice, because if you guys don't remember far back to, I think it was the summer of 2014, we were doing podcasts about Lost here on Post Show Recaps. We were doing a series called Lost Lives, which we still do very sporadically here on Post Show Recaps when the occasion calls for it. And we were basically in the run-up to the 10-year anniversary of Lost's series premiere. We were doing podcasts talking about our favorite characters, favorite episodes, everything. And Joe and AJ were big parts of that. AJ, who obviously is a fixture here in RHAP and Post Show Recaps, and Joe, who's a friend of mine that I've known for years now. We were on set together in Vancouver, and I don't remember what year it was, but it was for Fringe, it was for V. So Joe and I met on the job, and then these two met, and the dropship was born.
That's pretty much the origin story right there.
Pretty much.
We all bond over our love of Lost. And then I'd like to take credit, AJ, for recruiting you to the 100 first.
Oh, absolutely. For me, I didn't really know much about the show. In fact, I've gone on record as saying this. I think the title is probably the worst thing about the show, because I always conflated it with the show The 4400, and I actually thought that's what it was. So I was very confused. But you kept talking about it on Twitter. And finally, I said, all right, fine. It's on Netflix. I'm going to just dive right in. I watched the first episode and I was like, I'm not entirely sure. It's good, but I don't really get it just yet. But, you know, by the end of episode 3, I had tweeted you and said, okay, you got me. I'm in.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people who are in our orbit, and really, even if they're not in our orbit, but if they're just in Joe's orbit, have probably been compelled to watch The 100 at this point. Because you've been beating that drum very hard for when did you get into the show, Joe?
It's funny. I watched it casually, and then things started heating up in season 2, even before Lexa arrived, who I love as a character, and I just started getting more interested, and then I see, you know, people I respect like Mo Ryan and Eric Goldman really, really talking about it. Again, like, this is very full circle. Everyone's inspiring everyone to get into it for different reasons. Certain episodes made my brain twitch a little like they did with Lost, and I thought, there's no way. I can't write about this show. I don't have time. And then I had to just give in and decide that next season I'm going to cover this show, and I don't know for who. And then my friend Aaron from Sci-Fi Mafia reached out and said, please, please write for Sci-Fi Mafia. You have full editorial control. And I said, you have been, hello.
Yeah. So yeah, so that's where Joe is at. Joe is going to be doing all sorts of analysis. I mean, if you don't know Joe's Lost blogs from when Lost was on, you're really missing out on some super in-depth nerdery. That's kind of Joe's game, and it's really great, enjoyable material to read if you're a big fan of something. And Joe, when she latches on to a show, she really latches on. So you've really latched on to The 100.
I have latched on and I don't see any chance of letting go.
So let's just set up what we're doing here. AJ and Joe, they've got their own podcast about The 100. They've got The Dropship. They're talking about stuff. They'll talk about what they've been doing on that podcast. But what we also want to do here is just have you guys get a little bit more awareness of The 100 if you're not already into it. So we're going to talk about the show in broad strokes. We're also going to talk about it in detail. We'll sound the alarm once we're starting to get into spoiler territory, because there's a lot of that stuff that I want to pick apart with Joe and AJ. And then we'll answer a bunch of questions that you guys have sent in as well. And we'll talk about predictions for season 3, all sorts of fun stuff going on here. But just generally, AJ, can you set up what The 100 is for somebody who has not encountered the show, has no idea, has only heard the title, and maybe is having 4,400-ish type of thoughts that you're having?
The 100, it was a book first, kind of a young adult science fiction, Hunger Games-y kind of dystopian future feel to it. It's kind of, when it starts off, it's kind of a Lord of the Flies meets Battlestar Galactica in a way, with a bit of a debt to Lost to it. It's basically the story of a dystopian future, about 97 years past an incident on Earth when all of mayhem went, nuclear explosions, boom, bah, boom, boom, all life done. And the only survivors are on this, the space stations, the countries of the world, that whoever was not on the Earth at the time, they got to survive. And they kind of linked up their space stations into what they call the Ark. And they are what they believe to be the last of humanity. And so that's kind of where we join the story as the supplies are starting to run out, and the last of humanity really has nowhere else left to go. So what they decide to do is they decide to send 100 delinquents, kids who have been convicted of crimes, on the Ark. Because supplies are so limited, any crime is considered a capital offense, but only once you become an adult. If you're a kid, they just lock you up. But these kids have been in jail for varying degrees of crimes, some, you know, very petty, but any offense gets you arrested. And they decide, well, we got to find out if the Earth is survivable. Let's just send them down and see what they see. And that's kind of where our story takes off.
Yeah, that's where things begin. We focus mostly on the kids who are on the ground. There's also still characters on the Ark that we're focusing on. But Joe, can you highlight some of the characters that we are watching this show through to begin with? Some of the first characters, some of the first most important characters that we're going to get to know when The 100 is starting.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to start with Clark Griffin, the young girl locked up in her cell drawing on the floor. And, you know, I know you've now seen 2 seasons, and this isn't a spoiler to say that her character transformation has been nothing short of stunning. So to see this, you know, youngish blonde girl locked in a cell and you're not sure why, you feel kind of like it is, you're watching the show unfurl through her eyes, even though she's not, you know, the narrator or the storyteller. So Clark, her mother, is a doctor on the ship, and she's a political figure on the ship. So Clark herself is important in her lineage up on the Ark, and she's certainly obviously one of the main characters. And then there's Bellamy, who is obviously a bit of a rebel and has a sister that we learn later. I don't think this is a spoiler. So he has a sister that he had to hide, Octavia. And later on, he basically had to take drastic measures to ensure that he was with his sister when they were both sent down to Earth. So those are your 2 major characters, but, you know, John Murphy, Jasper, Raven comes in a little bit later. There are many people to follow, but the main 2 are Bellamy and Clark.
Yeah. I think you just touched on something that I think is really interesting, and I know that, AJ, you brought this up in one of your dropship podcasts, is this sort of mention of how does Bellamy have a sister? No one has siblings in this world. And it's sort of just like a briefly mentioned aside, but it hints at a really big deal portion of this culture. And I think that that's one of the things that this show does very well, is it has this set of rules that they don't just really drop on your lap. You really kind of have to go digging for it, and it starts to unfold very naturally as you start to learn a little bit more about the culture of this universe. So can you talk a little bit about the culture of The 100 and what life is like on the Ark versus what life is like on the ground, and what people are going to find as those 2 worlds kind of collide?
Well, I think one of the things that I do like about this show is in most pilots and in the first episode, I know some people have a hard time getting through the episode. But I think what it does that a lot of pilot episodes don't do, it doesn't spend a lot of time on exposition. It kind of just hits the ground running, and it's little throwaway lines of dialogue that you kind of have to listen very carefully to kind of learn things. So you mentioned the line where it's a character off screen kind of in the back going, "Sister, nobody has a sister." And it's a throwaway, but if you listen to it, you're like, "Oh, no one has a sister." And that's kind of what life is on the arc, is that parents can only have one child. There's limited resources. They cannot have a second child. If you commit a crime of any sort, whether it's stealing food to feed your family, because resources are so limited, they're just going to float you, which basically means taking you to the airlock and ejecting you out into the cold nothingness of space because, you know, you've committed a crime. You are no longer worthy of the limited resources. So it's kind of that kind of cruel but necessary dictatorship that's going on the ship. And there's political struggles. There's different factions. We're talking about people from 12 different countries that have come together, living on different parts of the ship. But in that sense, it's also a very multicultural environment. And that's what's kind of cool about it, too, is like you have people who kind of represent all of the Earth. And so there's that going on as well. And there's political intrigue going on the arc because when we first joined the show, Thelonious Jaha is kind of the commander, and he kind of seems to be the more kind, reasonable kind of leader. But there's also Kane, who is played by, of course, Desmond from Lost, our good friend Henry Ian Cusack.
Desmond, brother!
Brother, see you in another life. But he's kind of more of the hard ass, and he kind of is much more sinister at the start of the series. And you begin to see that even though everybody has the survival of the human race as the ultimate goal, and the human race is now dwindling down to a precious few, the way you make the choices on survival, do you become a little more selfish? Do you do, you know, it's kind of a Star Trek kind of thing, you know, are the rights of the many over the rights of the one? It kind of becomes that kind of debate going on. So it's really heady stuff. And The 100 does not shy away from really, from the get-go, making the characters make really difficult moral decisions.
Yeah, the morality of the show gets really, really intense. If it's not immediately apparent in season one, it really goes there in season two. But I do think in the beginning, especially the first episode of the show, I know that there's a lot of talk about how that doesn't quite hook some people in. A lot of people have been resistant that I've encountered with that first episode. And for me, it was that way as well. AJ, what's your take on sort of the divisiveness maybe of the pilot?
Well, I think very importantly, and I know Joe has probably had a lot to say about this too, but I think the first episode, because it's on the CW, and it is very teen-based, you know, you got this group of kids on the ground. You know, on the arc, you got grown-ups and political intrigue, but a lot of the first episode is obviously following the 100 as they go down to the ground, you know, and you got Imagine Dragons playing on the soundtrack, and you know, they're all walking around, and it's very like, "Woo, we got no parents, we're gonna rule." So it does have a feel where you're like, "Oh, is this just gonna be, you know, beautiful teenagers and making out and you know, throwing raves or something?" It has that feel to it. It doesn't stay there, but I understand why people might have resistance right off the bat. I certainly did as well. If it wasn't for Joe like saying, "No, trust me," and I do trust her, you know, I probably would have not come back for episode two.
Joe, what was your take when you first started encountering the 100? Were you hooked in immediately, or do you share a lot of people's reservations when they talk about that first episode? And for me, it was the first few episodes, and there's a big reason why that I want to talk to you guys about in a little bit. But for you, were you sucked in immediately, or do you see you know, why people struggle with it to start with?
I liked the pilot, but I didn't love it. I was sort of half-assed paying attention, if I'm being honest, because I like to give every new show a few episodes. And then all of a sudden at the end, when they that's when I knew. That's when I knew this was going to be maybe a different show than my preconceived notion about it being a CW show, to be honest. And I thought, okay, they're giving something really, really meaty here to work with. This is, you know, John Locke standing on a rock saying, "We're not the only ones on the island, and you all know it."
Right.
You know, this is a declaration that they are not alone on Earth. And oh boy, they're going to really encounter some serious dangers. It's time to get down in the dirt and start making plans, kids. So really, it took till episode three to hook me like everyone else. It's not necessarily Walkabout, but it's the episode with Charlotte and Wells. And I don't want to say too much for people who haven't necessarily watched it yet, but I think you all know what a game-changing moment that was. And that's the point at which most people have tweeted me saying, I was into it, and then the end of season episode three, I'm like, okay, you got me.
Yeah. So I think this is an interesting place. I think right now we're going to start talking about some of the specifics of the show. So that's all premise. That's all set up. It's a really exciting, action-packed show that has a lot of twists and turns in terms of darkness of the story. And it does have sort of the CW sheen that it begins with. But as you dig deeper into the show, it really goes dark and gets really mature and is dealing with really big, big conflicts and questions of morality and what's the right thing to do. And very quickly, any facade of heroes versus villains falls away, and it really becomes about us versus them. And that's a really compelling thing to get through. So if you're curious about checking it out, I strongly suggest checking it out. But there's no way for me anyway to keep talking about this going forward without starting to talk into the specifics of that third episode. So here's your final spoiler alert. This is the episode where Wells does not make it out alive, correct?
Yes.
I really didn't like that, and that really bummed me out. And I know that I tweeted this at you, Joe, and I find it interesting that a lot of people have responded to you by saying that this was the episode that hooked them in, because I remember a few months ago reaching out to you and saying, Joe, I don't know if the 100's for me. I'm really disappointed with what they just did to Wells. It seems really arbitrary. It feels almost mean-spirited. I was really bummed out by what they did. Have you heard that complaint very much, or is it really mostly been people were hooked by that moment?
I think most people were hooked. To be honest, there are only two people in my life who said that disturbed them to the point they didn't want to watch anymore, and it was my mother and you.
Uh-huh. I like your mom.
But it's a game changer.
Yeah.
And so the stakes have been raising, you know, subtly. And this was a very blatant, like, we are not messing around. They did a really good job quickly of world building, in my opinion, both, you know, from the Ark to the kids to the Grounders, you know, that you slowly but surely hear about and meet. And so I feel like they upped the stakes big time by killing him off.
Yeah, I think that for me, it was just it felt like it came out of nowhere in terms of the character, in terms of how he died. It wasn't, you know, he wasn't killed by one of the Grounders. He was killed by, you know, this young child who was part of the 100. And I felt like they didn't deal with the consequences of it very much. I felt like Clark moves past the Wells thing fairly quickly. AJ, do you think that I'm alone in this, or do you think that this is something that's fair?
Well, I mean, to me, the shock value of the actual murder is what hooked me, because, you know, you don't really see that coming. It comes out of left field. And the fact that she throws his own dialogue, you know, kind of his advice right back at him, you know, that to me is what's great about it. Just like, you know, she gets some good advice in the episode, you know, about, you know, oh, you know, just you gotta put the demons away, and then like, well, here are my demon kind
right.
of thing. Like that to me was what was really cool about it. Is like, it didn't, even though it came out of nowhere plot wise, in terms of from her point of view, and we're not seeing the show from Charlotte's point of view, it did make sense that she would do that if she considers Wells to be the demon. And it to me signaled that this show is going to be working on a level that was a little bit deeper than I thought. In terms of, do the sins of the father come to this, you know, go on the son? Do the sins of your parents? Are you becoming your parents? And I think that was kind of a precursor to that. And it's a theme that goes throughout the entire first season. Whereas, you know, is Clark responsible for the acts of her mother? Is Clark responsible for the acts of her father? You know, are all these people whose parents have pretty much sent them to the earth to die, are these kids beholden to their parents? And I think that is an interesting kind of point of view that I don't think has really ever been explored on television before.
Yeah, certainly not in this way. I mean, it's definitely done in a really big way. Maybe I'm just so Team Wells. I loved that guy. I thought he was great. I wanted to see so much more from him. You know, he was so heroic in the fact that he didn't need to come down to Earth. He just, you know, was coming down to help protect Clark and all of that.
Get in line.
Yeah. But I also just felt like he got forgotten very fast. And, you know, obviously the story moves very quickly and there's not a lot of time to dwell on the departed, as we certainly see in season two. But I just felt like they really moved past the Wells of it all very quick. And I stopped watching for a little while. I watched the next couple of episodes after that And as it became clear to me that the Wells thing wasn't going to hang so heavily, I was disappointed. And I moved on for a little while. But then, Joe, it was your birthday a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I promised you that I would watch a couple episodes of The 100 on your birthday. And by the time that I was done with season two, I think only like 36 hours had passed since I had written to you that I was going to keep watching the show. So clearly something hooked me in really fast. And I think it's another moment that I know, AJ, that you've responded to, is the moment on the bridge when the Grounders and Clark, when they first meet up, when Clark encounters Anya for the first time. And Anya kind of lays out her perspective of things, of how things have played out from their side. Can you talk a bit about that moment and why you think that that's a moment that really speaks to the things that this show gets right?
Yeah, well, the Unity Day episode, season one, episode 9, is still my favorite episode of the show. And I just think it had come just on the heels of an episode, which kind of felt to me what it's the only episode of this series, Day Trip, which is kind of one of those, oh, and this is the episode where we do this, and it kind of feels like it's just a standalone kind of, oh, I was worried that the show was going to turn into one of these, you know how Gilligan's Island was kind of like, oh, and this is the episode where this character shows up, and then we deal with this character, and then, oh, we didn't get rescued, and this is the episode where this character. I was worried that the 100 was turning into that with Day Trip. But Unity Day comes in, and not only do we have an incredible moment on the ship with a terrorist bombing that comes out of nowhere, which is just gut-wrenching, but we also have we meet Anya, and she tells Clark all these things that have happened in the first 8 episodes from the Grounder's point of view, and everything she says makes absolute sense. You burned down our village. And then Clark's like, no, it was just flares that we sent up. Some warning. Oh, wait a second. Yeah, I guess we did burn down your village. And the fact that Clark recognizes that Anya's point of view is valid. And you see Anya reacting to that going, oh, I didn't think you'd recognize that my point was valid. And there's like just a acting tour de force there of two women who are just looking at each other going, I didn't expect you to be the way you are, and now I have to reevaluate everything on the fly. And it's just a great moment because I also reevaluated the show on the fly in that sequence. And it just I was floored. I've never seen a scene that was so full of subtext. And it was just fascinating to me. And if I wasn't hooked before then, and I was starting to feel a little bit, maybe not that. I mean, that episode from start to finish was like propelled the show. And from that point on, the momentum never stopped.
Yeah, no, Unity Day is great. And I think that that was the episode that really hooked me in. I was like, okay, now I really just got to keep watching. I'd already been dedicating a couple hours to watching the show at that point. And I was like, I'm just going to keep going. I've got nothing else going on this weekend. And if I do, I'm canceling my plans. So I cozied up with my Netflix and I was really, really into it. But AJ, you touched on something. I want to get your take on this, Joe, is this meeting with Clark and Anya where they're talking things through and their perspectives are both so clear from both sides that, you know, you'd have to be kind of unintelligent not to recognize that both of them have really valid points. And it's unusual to see that on a show like this, where just for a moment, it looks like diplomacy might work, like conversation might be able to get us through if we can really just acknowledge each other and talk things through. And then, of course, guns come out and bows and arrows come out and people are shooting at each other and the conversation ends very abruptly. But I think that this is one of the things that the show does really well, and I'd love to get your take on this, you know, sort of the tension between diplomacy and war. There's always these moments, whether it's here with Clark and Anya or Clark and Lexa or just, you know, a group of Grounders and a group of Sky people who are supposed to hold together, but just like one wrong move could push them to the brink of war. And this is just something that seems to happen so often and so deftly on the show, this sort of tension between we have to get along versus it's so hard for us to get along because all I want to do is punch you people in the face.
Right. And at that point, the Sky people and the Grounders are not that familiar with each other at all. You know, Clark's people behind her with guns ready to aim, see the tree people, you know, the tree crew in the trees, they panic. They yell, they shoot first because they are trigger happy after Jasper. And so you kind of understand that perspective, but I think it did take Anya and the Grounders by surprise. And that was, you know, it didn't signal war, but any communication successfully set up between Anya and Clark was negated by that action, obviously, and just set off a series of events. I mean, this is a show that expect the unexpected, but also that's one of the first inklings of this is a show where we don't know who the commander is, we don't know who the grounders are, but this is a show where I think a lot of the leaders are going to be female, and it's also a point that is irrelevant. No one makes a big deal out of it. No one points out how old people are. No one points out what gender they are or what any kind of distinguishing factor. They just go with it. And that's one of the things I love about this, the world that Jason Rothenberg and the writers have created for us.
Yeah, I think that that's something that can't be stressed enough. You know, you and I, AJ as well, we're all huge Lost fans. It's a show that's very near and dear to our hearts. But one thing that Lost maybe didn't do so well is it didn't have a plethora of strong women on the show. There are certainly people that you could point out, Juliet for one. You know, there's definitely characters you can identify, but The 100 is packed with strong female characters, just really excellent characters top to bottom, from Clark and Raven to the person who I think is the best character on the show, Lexa, and I don't think that that's an unpopular opinion. It's just really just loaded with these incredibly strong women, and I think that you hit on something that I'd like to hear more of your take on when you say that it doesn't matter that they're women, that is not really in the equation at all. Can you talk about the writing of that and how you feel that factors into the show and why people are resonating with the show as much as they are?
Absolutely. I mean, you have women like Octavia and Raven, who have transformed tremendously, just as Clark has, and Abby, who is a healer, a leader, and a mother. You have some relatable factor for every character, not just the females, but this is a very female-led show. You have Raven, who has a disability. She does not complain. She's arguably the strongest character on the show. She's a person of color who has a disability and is also a mechanical engineer. Those three things are not necessarily something you see on television every day. It's important that they all are represented, but that they don't point it out. I think that Lindsay Morgan and Jason Rothenberg and company would agree with me that it is important that those characters exist, but there's no agenda behind it. I don't think that they have, in the writer's room, boxes to check for sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender. I think that they write to their strengths, which is progressive modern society set in horrible circumstances. And I think that it is important to point out, yes, that there are a lot of strong women on this show. They co-lead successfully with the men. But I think one of the reasons this show is successful is, despite the war and the blood, the bullets, the swords, there is a lot of emotion. There are a lot of realistic characteristics that you can relate to or aspire to, whether it be, the stoicism and behind Commander Lexa, whether it be the resourcefulness of Clark Griffin or the absolute power of Octavia Blake. There is something for everyone, men and women.
Yeah, it's fun because the show, there's something recognizable about it. I mean, obviously, we don't live on a spacecraft that's orbiting a planet unless, we're all about to wake up and find out something pretty crazy. but, you can see humanity going in the direction that humanity goes in on this show, if you want to take a really pessimistic viewpoint of the way of the world. Certainly, there's the threat of, real danger in this world and people not getting along and, social classes conflicting and races conflicting and all sorts of types of people coming to all sorts of conflict. And this show is a very extreme version of that. And yet it takes the end of the world for equality to come about. Have you ever thought about how the people on The 100 got to the point where all of these things, where it doesn't matter what your gender is, what your sexual orientation is, what your race is, you can still be in positions of power and do just about anything that anyone else can do? How did the world of The 100 blow itself up and then get to this incredibly socially progressive place?
Well, the way it got to the socially progressive place it is, I mean, I talked about this a little bit on our last episode of The Dropship, is that, here in America, being prejudiced and being kind of, exclusionary and hating people because of differences, it's a luxury. And I don't mean that as a good thing. I just mean that we have it pretty good in this country. And so therefore we have time to look at differences and to try and poke fights. And
we can afford to be mean to each other.
Yeah. I mean, you took these people on space stations with no resources, no choice but to work together, no choice but to live together and try to survive. And now it's a couple of generations past. They don't have time for any of the pettiness. They don't have time for any of this nonsense. It's like, I don't care what you look like. We got to band together or else we're going to die. I mean, I don't want to go live together, die alone, but I mean, it is kind of like that. There are no other options here. You know, now that they're back on the ground, and one of the things I'm interested in seeing in season three is, you know, they're on the ground. They have a lot more resources than they had on the Ark. They have, at least at the start of the season, it would seem there might be a period of peace going on, at least right at the start of the season. Are these kind of prejudices and are these kind of class differences or whatever develops, is humanity going to go down that road again? And I think we might very well see that in season three, because now they have the luxury of having a little spare time on their hands.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, like now that they are saved and they're on Earth, it's almost like that's going to be, there's something poisonous about this planet, maybe. I don't know. There's something something in the water. Joe, can we start talking about some of like the crazy season two shenanigans?
Please do.
Where should we start? Which is like for you, what do you think is like, because I know that you've said to AJ, you guys had a really great conversation about this on your first podcast about how AJ, you started to feel like you could see some of the bullets coming on season two in the sense that you felt like really locked into the show. And Joe, you said that season two was really just like consistently blowing your mind. What was the first point that season two just really rocked your world?
Gosh, I don't know what the first point would be, but I think the ultimate game changer and moving the story forward and surprise of my life was Finn.
Yeah, in terms
of when Finn guns down the village, that shocked me because I didn't think they'd go there. I didn't love Finn. He was fine. He was just a character that existed to me.
Is that okay to say?
What?
Is it okay to say that Finn's just fine? Because I feel like my stance on Finn is so much like sub-lukewarm. Am I going to get killed by the 100 fans if I admit that?
No, because I don't think he was beloved. He's no Bellamy, you know? He's no Monty like a precious cinnamon roll. Don't worry about it.
Okay, good. So this was an opinion that people were just like, Finn.
Right. Like, Finn existed. He had a thing with Clark. Not sure if love was exactly the word between them, but, they satisfied something within one another. And I think that the cause and effect of what he did is tremendous. It's fantastic in terms of moving everything forward in a very fast manner. Not only his massacre, but the way they handled it moving forward with him being, handed to the grounders and Clark making the decision to take his life mercifully. That to me, that is the most shocking sequence so far on the show.
Yeah, I think after that, anything becomes possible, and like they definitely don't, decrease the volume and impact of what they can do in the show. But it is after that moment where it just feels like, all right, well, we killed off arguably our male love interest really just like we called our shot. We told you that this was going to happen in this episode, and we delivered on it. So now what can we do? We can do anything.
Kylo Ren, man.
Yeah, exactly. AJ, what's your take on the whole Finn of it all? Were you a fan of the character? Are you more a fan of the moment? What's your take on Finn?
First of all, just to go back just a little bit, I mean, to me, the thing that was really exciting about season two was the kind of left turn that the entire series took at the end of season one, when, it kind of ends with the dropship, and the charring of all the grounders. And then all of a sudden we get, soldiers with laser sights coming out and Anya saying mountain men and gas. And they're like, where are we? What the heck is going on? And Clark suddenly in like a medical facility that looks like it's right out of Resident Evil. I mean, to me, that was very exciting and like, oh my God, where is this series going? I do think that Finn's course of action in season two, I don't think they had a clear path for him. I don't think he was needed anymore. And I thought his descent into madness, I get the fact that Clark was gone and he had to get her back, but I thought the descent into madness was the only thing that didn't ring true. And I don't know if it was just because the acting didn't quite work, but I thought it was very bizarre. And the fact that he went through with the massacre just showed how far gone he had gone. I didn't think the pacing of that worked, but I thought that everything that they did after that, from Clark taking matters into her own hands, and that just propelled the series for the second half of season two in an amazing way. So I don't necessarily know that they knew what they were doing with the character, and I think that was the problem.
Yeah, I don't know where to assign it, but I think that there's something there, you know, whether it's on the acting, if it's on the writing. I do think that, you know, Finn takes such a turn. You know, Finn is the pacifist. He's the, we're not going to shoot each other. We're not going to go to war. We can do this through diplomacy. And then he's doing things in the beginning of season two where Bellamy, of all people, is like, whoa, dude, come on. So I think that there's something there. And, you know, I don't know that I love that's, I don't know that I love the way that it played. I don't know that it felt completely earned when it's, you know, when you're in a village and you're Finn and John Murphy is with you, and John Murphy is the guy who's telling you, like, dude, you're going a little loco right now. You know, that felt a little weird to me that's where they took Finn, but they take Finn there. And I think that, you know, so many other shows could have just let Finn off the hook. They could have, you know, thrown him into some sort of, I don't know. I don't think that they've got the luxury of rehab yet here on or some anger management classes that they could throw Finn's way. But I feel like a lot of shows would have found a way to write Finn out of that corner. And it probably wouldn't have rung true, but it's just, you know, we got to hang on to that character. But the 100 doesn't do that. The 100 comes back with an episode a couple episodes later and says, the only way that we can have a truce between the Grounders and the Sky People is if you give us Finn and let us, like, torture him by, you know, setting him on fire and doing all sorts of horrible stuff to him, and then he gets to die. And they don't go quite that far, thanks to Clark, but the show does go there. And I think for me, I was already really into it. It was that scene. It was Unity Day, that episode that was probably the first episode. I was like, oh, this is a pretty good show. This is really, really good. But when Spacewalker happens and Finn gets killed the way that he gets killed, with Raven watching in the distance, from then on, if you're not just, like, locking yourself in a room and watching the next 8 episodes in a row, you must have some very important plans that day.
Amen, brother.
And you with the, you know, your lost love, I mean, that episode, Spacewalker, is really an episode of Lost in many ways, because we're getting the flashbacks to what was going on in the Ark, and we were getting that surprise reveal of who the Spacewalker really was. And I thought that was, I know why you like that episode so much, because it really did feel like an episode of Lost to me.
Yeah, 100%, 100%, the 100%. Because, you know, I love that reveal that, like, you know, he had this reputation as the Spacewalker, and that's, like, such a cool nickname. It's, oh my God, Finn, what a rebel, what a renegade. And really, he wasn't that. He was just a guy who fell on the sword for his friend, for his girlfriend at the time. And that was a really cool reveal. That was very Lost-like. So yeah, that was a really big turning point for me. And I've described this to some people, and at first I wasn't sure if this was a positive or a negative. I've come around to being happy about it. Do you guys play the Telltale video games at all, or do you know what they are?
I do not.
Nope.
Do you know the Walking Dead video game? It's created by this company called Telltale. And Telltale excels in creating games that are really narratively driven, where they're not particularly difficult to play in terms of, like, you're not going to get through this part without losing and playing it a million times. What's difficult is the choices you have to make. You get to make really customizable, flexible, moral decisions in these games that dictate the outcome of what comes next. It's not like you have to get through this really difficult level. It's how do you get through this level and what choices do you make along the way? And oftentimes it's like picking between one character to throw at the zombies or another character to throw at the zombies. And it's really intense and really exciting to play as a player. And that sort of tension was what was coming to mind the most through the scene with Finn, where Clark has a really, really difficult set of choices. There are no good choices for her here. She's got a knife with her. She has instructions from Raven to, if you can't get Finn out of there, kill Raven, and in the chaos, we'll go rescue Finn. She could do that and risk the lives of so many people, or she could go over to Finn and end him quickly and hopefully keep the truce that way. And it really felt to me like the experience of playing, which I really recommend to you guys, if you're Walking Dead fans, if you're Game of Thrones fans, they've got a Game of Thrones game, is playing one of those games where you just feel terrible about whatever you're going to do next. Like, you don't want to do any of the things, but you have to make a choice. And it's a really, really huge moment for the show. Obviously a huge turning point for Clark, and far from the last horrible decision that Clark is going to make in season two. And probably
one small correction. Raven gave her the knife to kill Lexa, not Raven.
No
worries.
Bungled it a little bit. You know what I meant.
Let's talk about how grateful we are that that didn't happen.
Yeah. Here, take this knife and kill me. That would have been strange. That would have been weird. Can we talk about Lexa? Because this is around the time that Lexa becomes prominent on the show. She is awesome. As I mentioned, she's my favorite character. Do you think that that's the reaction from a lot of people? People are really big on Lexa, right?
I would say so. I mean, independently of Clark, a lot of people, obviously, because of the end of season two and what they're thinking season three, have a lot of hope for them romantically. I think we need to do Lexa justice, which is to talk about her singularly, because she's such a badass. And wow, wait till you see season three. I'm a tease. I know. Sorry.
I know. Joe has seen the first four of season three. No spoilers. She
just
promised.
How this? Oh my God. Okay, moving on. Yes, we all share an appreciation for Commander Lexa. She's so layered and fascinating, and holds her cards, you know, close to the vest. And you really, she says so much with her eyes and so much with body language. It's kind of unbelievable.
The way she says Clark is like the greatest word ever spoken by anybody in the history of humanity. Like, just every time she's like, "Come on, Clark." She's like, "Oh, Alexa, say it again."
You are making the thirsty fans very happy right now.
It's true. It's incredible. Listen, I've listened to you guys on the dropship. You don't necessarily feel like there's a super, super romance brewing with Clexa, as the kids call it.
I disagree with that statement. I think that we're trying to be open-minded and fair.
Measured.
Right. I mean, yeah. Listen, it's no secret that I love Lexa as a character, and I do root for Clark and Lexa, but I'm a realist, and it's a sci-fi show set in a post-apocalyptic future. So I've written an article too saying I wouldn't mind Clark Griffin, the legend of Clark Griffin, you know, being Clark alone. She doesn't need necessarily a romantic partner or constant to achieve greatness.
Sure. I mean, well, she already killed one of her love interests, so, you know, she's going to be just fine if it doesn't work out.
Right.
But I got to imagine, AJ, I'd love to get your take on this. Like, from the writer's perspective and the way that Lexa is played and everything, whether or not, you know, happy endings notwithstanding, and I do not, for a number of reasons, I do not anticipate a happy ending for Clexa, but do you feel like that is a direction that the show is writing toward, that Lexa at least really has strong feelings towards Clark?
Well, I think what's great about the show, and part of the reason that I did think that the show wasn't not predictable, but I felt that everything that happened on season two especially was because of something that came before. And I don't feel that any other than the rush to get Finn to where they needed to get him, I don't think anything didn't come about naturally. And I think that that's what was so great about their kiss, was that it seemed earned to me. All their interactions up to that, it didn't come out of nowhere. It was kind of a surprise, and I think it surprised them as well. And I think that was what was kind of cool about it, is that it was earned. And so I don't know that, again, Joe says this, there's no agenda here. This is what these characters are doing. And it because right. It rings true, it works. If it didn't ring true, it wouldn't work. So, I mean, I'm happy with anything that rings true on this show. And while they don't necessarily hit 100% on it, I think they're pretty much batting 90-95%, and that's amazing.
Yeah, that's good. You know, a lot of shows get to like 70% and we're like, that's pretty good. We're good with that. We're happy with that. But this show does fire on numerous cylinders.
And the other thing, Josh, that you have to take into account is that, you know, we're dealing with a character, unfortunately, is not, the actress is not exclusive to this show.
I know,
And, you know, you and I are probably going to get stuck watching her hang out with her, you know, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, droopy old man clothes brother on Fear the Walking Dead going forward. And so that may spell a little premature end to Clexa, but maybe not. And that's what's also kind of cool is that at least she's still on the show, and they've allowed Alicia to actually continue to act on The 100. So there's still a window of opportunity there. So I think it's great that we don't know what's going to happen. It's not a case where, oh, she's on another show, so we're just going to kill her. That's not happening. She's on the show this season. It's great.
Yeah. What's like, you know, I'm not plugged into the 100 fandom. I'm curious to know what the 100 fandom is about. So I've got a couple of questions on that for you guys. But let's just start here with Lexa. Joe, what is like the threat level? Like how afraid are people that because Alicia is on Fear of the Walking Dead, that she's just doomed to die on the 100, that she's just not going to be around for a while? Is there like serious nerves, tension, anxiety in the air? Is it palpable from your position?
Huh. First of all, I'm going to correct you because you keep saying the 100. It's the 100. Come
the
on,
100.
Now.
The 100. The 100. The
100. Yes, we are at code red in terms of Lexa panic. I have deemed it PCDA, which is premature commander death anxiety. Did a video about it because I was like, okay, people, come on. I get it. Let me tell you, though, why Alexa is so important to people, and I can certainly relate on some levels. This is a character who is young. This is a character who is essentially the most powerful human being on the planet that we know of on the 100. She is for all intents and purposes, she's the commander-in-chief. She is extremely powerful. She struggles visibly between her responsibility to her people and her heart. And I think this is something that people can relate to. The fact that she lost her former love to violence because of her job, at its core, that is really the truth of the matter. And that she opened up her heart to someone new and then had to shut it down again because of being the president of the country, essentially. She represents so much for so many people. You have to point out that this is a character that also happens to be a lesbian, okay? Yeah. This is important to people like me. I have been out for 20 years. I've watched a lot of television, as you know. I can't even imagine what a character like Commander Lexa would have done for me when I was coming out. I'm actually tearing up a little talking about this.
Yeah,
kind of
sure.
Surprising. She means a lot to a lot of people. There are a lot of LGBT youth out there. LGBTQT. You know the letters.
Yes.
they watch this show, and it's very important to them that bisexual Clark and lesbian Lexa, not that those are their titles, that they are written and exist, and written, I think, rather beautifully and realistically, despite the dire circumstances of the show. There are people who have talked about these characters with their families while coming out, and have talked on Tumblr about how the show has saved their lives because they have someone that they can watch that means so much to them. So I understand why people are prematurely panicking about Lexa. You know, obviously Alicia is a star and she has her own show, but the fact that she's on,
they should just kill her off on Fear of the Walking Dead and make everyone happy, right?
That's wish fulfillment, man. Wish fulfillment.
Like, I'd be good with that. Like, yes. I mean, she's a great actress and I'm happy to have her on Fear of the Walking Dead, but if we could kill her off there and make sure she's just like full time on the Hunge, I'm good.
The Hunge. First of all, I love you. I love that. Second of all, yes, I agree. So not to get, you know, too much on my pedestal, but every character means something to different people who watch the show. In particular, I understand why people are drawn to characters like Lexa, and there is a social responsibility of the show that AJ and I just talked about on our podcast, which you can't underline. It does exist as a show, but it is changing people's lives and making conversations happen. And so the progressive society that they have created, you know, will infiltrate into our society and perhaps make a difference.
Yeah. No, I think that those are all very, very big reasons why someone like Lexa resonates so much, and certainly a huge part of the reason why I love her as a character, why I think she's so great. What are some of the other relationships that people feel very, very hardcore about on this show? Are there any, like, you know, the shipping communities, the Jate is Fate people? How much of that exists around the Hunge, and what should I know? What are the landmines that I should avoid? What are the shippers that I want to hang out with? What's the state of fandom with the romances on this show?
AJ, should I take this one?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I'm going to stay on the sidelines of Balark versus Kalexa. Go ahead. It's all you.
Is this a big deal?
Well, okay. Let me start by saying that, you know, ship wars exist and they can't exist politely. And as time has gone by, I've found that to be the case. You know, in Cass Morgan's original book, The 100, Balark is set up. The Bellamy and Clark romance definitely exists and it's really well written. And I totally understand why fans, if you haven't read the book or not, you interpret Bob and Eliza's chemistry together, and you really hope that Blark happens. And, you know, Jason hasn't discounted it. I think in this world of the 100, anything could happen. You know, right now, a lot of people sort of argue back and forth about who is canon and who isn't. And it's all wish fulfillment. You know, it's for the most part, it's friendly. But the two biggest ships are definitely Clexa and Blark. But there are people who, you know, are excited for Cabby, which is Kane and Abby. People are fairly polite about Linktavia because they already exist, which is Lincoln and Octavia.
Yeah, that's obvious.
Yes. I'm not going to suggest there'll be new ships in the new season, but, you know, it's a new world. There's new characters. There are people who want Princess Mechanic, which is Raven and Clark. There are people who want Dr. Mechanic, which is Abby and Raven. So really, there's something for everyone.
Wow.
I think the one thing that we can all get behind is that none of us like Waven, which is Wick and Raven. And if Wick disappeared, I would not shed a tear.
Is Wick the Ryan Gosling light?
Yes.
He's Diet Gosling.
He is Diet Gosling for sure, and nobody really ships that. Don't worry.
Okay, so they'll take care of that.
I don't think really shipped Finn. I mean, maybe just sort of lately after the fact, you're like, yeah, no, that was not a good ship.
With Finn and
Flark.
Flark. Yeah. Well, the show was really pushing Flark for a while. I think one of the greatest things that this show did, you know, not just because it's such a big moment and such a big turning point for the characters and the plot, is I think we didn't need Finn anymore. We could get rid of Finn. I apologize for any of you huge Finn fans, but he's not doing anything.
Fair enough.
We were out of play. I agree. Could get rid of Finn. Let's talk about some of the other big moments from season two, which really tee us up for season three. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the finale, of course, and the decision that Clark makes alongside Bellamy and Monty to basically choose us over them in the most hardcore way humanly possible, where they actually wipe out all of Mount Weather, and they make that choice actively in order to save the rest of the Sky People. But, you know, if you thought that was just like a big jaw-dropping shock, I feel like it's really set up really, really well in the decision that Lexa and Clark make together of, let's let those missiles go to Tansi, let's just let it happen. We have to let it happen in order to preserve Bellamy's cover, all of this stuff. So these types of decisions are already being made in season two leading up to that moment. So, AJ, I know that you've said that you felt really plugged into season two. Were those moments big shocks for you, or were those moments inevitabilities based on what had been set up already?
It's not even that they were the shock. I think to me, the situations themselves were set up so beautifully and so wonderfully that you know, you kind of, you're sitting there going, I hope she doesn't do it. I hope she doesn't do it. I hope she doesn't do it. Oh my God, she did it. But I mean, what else could she have done? But you know, her and Bellamy to push the button, pull the lever. You know, I think they set things up. They set up this intricate plot where you have the three factions. You have the Grounders. You have the Sky People. You have Mount Weather. And all of the dominoes are put into place. And you get to that point where they're at the door and they are trying to get in and they're getting shot at. And then, you know, they have to use a flaming arrow to make sure that the door is triggered. And suddenly they succeed. And in that moment, Lexa has to say, sorry, but I have to do a switch for my people. And I made this side deal. And, you know, that's the end of part one of the finale. that's most shows, that's season cliffhanger. Yeah. No, we still got an hour left, people. You know, and the look on Clark's face, like, oh my God, what have you done? And then in just a short hour later, she's in the exact same spot and she makes the exact same decision. And that to me is why the show is so amazing, is that it took a character who was like, how could you do that? And then put her in the same situation and she makes the same choice. And that is just such amazing writing. And it's why I love the show so much.
Joe, what was your reaction to the finale?
Oh boy. Well, first of all, I love that are you talking about season two? Of course. They broke it into two, and they had the quote betrayal between Lexa and Clark happen in the first half, and that you could have really ended the entire season right there with Clark standing outside the door saying it can't be over. I thought that was a really sort of brave choice. I understood, and I love the line I had to choose with my head over my heart, because it's essentially quintessentially Lexa. and really describes her entire character in one sentence. It was heartbreaking. As I said, I do root for them, and Clark Griffin's my favorite character. And to see Eliza killed it. I mean, she's continuously upping her game and is such a great actress, but that scene, the look in her eyes, the look in both of their eyes haunts me, and I know haunts a lot of people. The season finale with the decision to kill off everyone in Mount Weather in order to save not only the Sky People, but really future grounders. That's something that I don't think people think about. It's not just us or them. It's saving an entire community, a township, a country. It is saving an entire clan, future generations. And so, you know, I have more perspective on it now, obviously months and months later, and I'm already, you know, starting to write about the new season. So I'm putting it in perspective, but I think it was bold and shocking. And I applaud the decision to have Clark do it. And I think that you will see, and this is spoiler free, not just Clark, but Monty and Bellamy deal with the ramifications of what they had to do. Sure, Clark made the decision to deal with it on her own, but everyone else who stayed has a post-traumatic stress disorder in their own way, particularly people involved with that decision.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, you know, I've been reading a little bit about the new season and some interviews with some of the actors. And I know that one of the ones that I was really enjoying reading today was with Devin Bostick. Is that how you say the
Bostick.
Actor who plays Bostick? Devin Bostick, who plays Jasper, and him talking about how he's just a wreck. And he's, you know, he's a character that's very, very difficult to be around right now, given what his friends did and how it directly impacted him with the death of Maya and everything. So you got to imagine that the fallout, even though there's going to be a little bit of a time jump between seasons 2 and 3, the fallout of that decision is massive for these people. And AJ, I think you touched on something that's really interesting about that creative choice to not end season 2 with Lexa revealing to Clark, like, yeah, I made a side deal. My people are good. Sorry, Clark. Very, very sorry about that, Clark. And she marches off. And on a lot of shows, that could have just been good enough to be the finale. Or, you know, the finale could have ended with, are they going to pull the lever? And you would have to wait all summer to find out if that was the case. But no, they pull the lever and you see it happen. And if there's a cliffhanger, it's, you know, it's not about the will they, won't they. It's about the what now that we did. And I think that that puts us in such a really interesting place emotionally with so many of these characters, almost all of these characters, whether they were the people who flipped the switch or the people who were impacted by the switch getting flipped. I think that that puts us in such a cool spot going into season 3.
And they filmed it so beautifully. It was brutal.
Yeah. And just, you know, the resolution in the moment of a lot of storylines was also fantastic. I think it's overlooked in the decision that, you know, just Clark and Abby having a moment because their relationship was so strained from the get-go. Once Clark finds out that it was Abby who turned in her father on the Ark and caused him to be floated. And that was something that was not healing properly. And then when Abby finds out that Clark knew about the missiles and did nothing, and she was like, how could you do that? How could you do that? You know, you're supposed to be one of the good people. And finally here, she saves her mom and she chooses to do this. And finally her mom sees that this was the right thing. It may not have been an ideal thing, but it was still the best scenario. And they have that moment when, you know, maybe there are no good people, you know, maybe you just got to be the best that you can be. And so there were these moments of real resolution there, between Indra and Lincoln, a moment of like, hey, you know, do what you have to do. And all this resolution that also serves as a jumping off point and a setup. And I think it's great that had the series been canceled after that, I would have felt there was enough resolution that, I mean, I would have hated it, but at least I felt there was enough resolution that I would have felt good about it and said, yeah, I wish we would have had more, but I feel good. And they tied a lot up. And I thought that was really, really smart of them because now they can go in any direction they want. And there's nothing left hanging over we don't have to resolve anything. They can make this time jump and take it in a completely different direction. And judging in how they went on a different direction from season 2 compared to season 1, I'm sure we're going down a crazy, crazy rabbit hole for season 3 coming up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, 100%, 100%. I mean, we can go from there to, yeah, I agree with you, AJ, that I think that if season two had ended the show, if that had been the ending of the show, I think a lot of the characters, a lot of the stories, I think would have been emotionally satisfying. I would have wanted more, and I'm really glad we're getting more, but I think I would have been good on most, but not all. And the big one is obviously the huge, huge, huge cliffhanger in season two, talking about how from season to season, the show seems to be veering into wildly different and unpredictable territory, is the moment where Jaha reaches the City of Light, encounters a hologram named Allie, confronts the fact that there is, you know, the nuclear warhead that he rode down, you know, Dr. Strangelove style back to Earth from the Ark is in this person's possession. And we just have no idea what that's going to be. Now, Joe, I know you've seen the first few. I know you can't say anything and I wouldn't want you to say anything, but this is something, this storyline, the Allie storyline, the City of Light storyline, this is something that has really captured your imagination.
I am, potentially obsessed, yes, with Allie. Yeah. I know a lot of fans, you know, this show does skew younger in an audience, and they're obviously more invested maybe in the Clarks and the Bellamys, the Octavias and the Ravens, and I get that. But I, you know, we are sci-fi fans, and this season is definitely, you know, headed more in that direction, while still giving plenty of character service to the others. You know, they do a really good job of, like they did last season, with both, you know, separate stories here. I will just say that I have been studying films like Blade Runner and The Matrix because I have an ongoing theory that I will reveal soon, but it is relating to, you know, Earth versus Earth and nature and dirt versus modern technology.
Interesting.
And how,
I like it.
How the two may combine, meet, or connect. And I'm trying to be vague here, but I would
That's
just
great.
Say nothing to do with what I've seen. It's just my theory. Because I'm obsessed. The singularity is here and it's near and it's, you should be full of fear because Allie is terrific. But what they do and what I love, and this is spoiler free, is yes, the Allie storyline is definitely more sci-fi than let's say the Clark storyline, but they handle it with humanity and they handle it in such a really interesting, fascinating way that you're not going to go, oh my God, I'm hit over the head with sci-fi.
Right.
It integrates really well into the overall story of The Hundred. And that's all I can say.
That's awesome. AJ, since you haven't seen these first few episodes, what are your theories about where the whole City of Light story is going? And I'm especially curious kind of to get your take on where you think Jaha is going. Jaha, who I think has been a really up and down character, who has been on one of the most interesting emotional roller coasters of anyone on this show. What's like the ultimate end game for him in relation to this story?
Well, I think one of the things that Jaha is kind of, you know, he's the man of faith and he is, you know, he's been, you got to believe, you know, he's wandering and leading his people through the desert towards the promised land, the City of Light. I mean, you can't get much more biblical allegory than that. You know, and he gets there and he finds this godlike creature in Allie. So, I mean, to me, his blind faith, I think, is going to play a huge part this season. And whether or not he is truly seeing what is actually there, if he's seeing what he wants to see, is his manipulation is going to be, I think, a really key facet of this. And the fact that he has brought someone who I can only hope will be Doubting Murphy along with him, maybe be able to, like, will he be able to, pardon the Hundred pun, to ground him a little bit, because I think Allie doesn't scare me as much as Jaha's blind faith to Allie scares me. And I think that is going to be the pivotal factor in season three.
Joe, do you think it's fair to compare? This is something that I've been thinking about recently, and having heard AJ's take on this really crystallizes it for me. Fair to compare Jaha of the Hunge to John Locke of Lost?
Absolutely. You know, I always encourage constructive conversation and comment.
Jahan Locke.
Jahan Locke. I have a little bit of a tangent here. People send me things from threads on message boards and forums. I don't ask for them. And one of the comments, I think, I don't know if it was on Reddit or wherever, was, I like Joe and AJ, but they talk about Lost too much, to which I say...
Uh-oh, they're going to hate this podcast.
We're not going to apologize because that was our world for 6 years, and it really set off most of our careers, so we're not going to apologize for that, and there are a lot of parallels. I do consider Jaha to be the John Locke in the sense because we still don't know. You know, John Locke wound up being a pawn and a patsy for the Man in Black. Well, is that Allie's role with Jaha? Is she using him? Did she recruit him? These are questions that I hope get addressed and answered. You know, he so believes in his own destiny. It's unbelievable. But it's also really riveting, and Isaiah Washington totally sells it. And so yes, he is John Locke in that sense. He's also has a leadership role and came from one, so he can apply that to his current situation. But it's a very Alice in Wonderland trail he is traveling down, and he is way more in the rabbit hole in season three than you ever could imagine.
Awesome. I love it. All right, you guys ready to answer some questions from our post-show recaps listeners?
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right, let's do it. So let's start off here with Umberto, who was really pumped up to find out that we were doing a podcast about this show. He says, my question is, has Clark crossed the line from hero to anti-hero? Have Clark and Bellamy changed roles at this point? What do you think about that, AJ?
No, I don't think she's an anti-hero by any means. I mean, an anti-hero is someone who is out for themselves, I mean, more than anything else. And she is not. She's doing something for the greater good. In fact, the fact that she's willing to walk away and bear it so that they don't have to, I mean, that's not an anti-hero. That's a hero in my book. Now, have they changed roles? I mean, I think Bellamy and Clark absolutely have changed roles. And the fact that he's going to be present and therefore, at least to the delinquents who are on the ground, the original 100, he's still going to be a leader, although I don't think he's going to necessarily take on a leadership role in regards with Kane and the grown-ups now that they've arrived. You know, the parents are back in town. I'm going to let them lead, but I think he's going to certainly be a liaison, and he's going to be the person that they look up to. So in that sense, he's taken over her leadership role because she's not there. But, I mean, to me, Clark is the hero of this story and will continue to be the hero of this story until she does something that I feel is in a selfish best interest as opposed to something for the greater good.
Just because you name dropped him, and I don't want to forget to ask this. This is a question of mine for you, Joe. On a scale of 1 to 100, or Hunge, if you'd prefer, on a scale of 1 to Hunge, how much do you think Henry Ian Cusack and the people who make the show regret not letting Henry Ian Cusack use his Scottish accent?
I'm going to go with 25%, only because... I think that the first two seasons,
I love him so much, but man, you can just tell he's like, oh, I wish I hadn't made that choice. Tough choice to try and go with the American accent.
Listen, Jason Rothenberg loved Lost. A lot of the writers did too. I imagine if they could write in the word brother, they would. Brother. but it will be a little on the nose. Not other things aren't on the nose, but, oh, and by the way, season three has Beardy Kane, and Beardy Kane is very reminiscent of season three Desmond, so you'll be happy in that aspect.
I'm a fan.
Yes, but I think that the first two seasons they were figuring out Kane's accent, or maybe Ian was, and it is definitely settled in season three.
Okay, they've improved it. He's just gone full Scott at this
point. Yes, and you know, we all love Henry and Cusick because of Lost, and also for the Hunch, but I would say if you're a Kane fan, I think you're going to really like season three.
Are you a Kane fan?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I also like that he started off sort of not villainous, but that he was questionable at best with his decision making. And now, you know, sort of like Clark and Bellamy co-lead, he and Abby have this interesting co-leading relationship. And, you know, obviously I don't like spoilers, and I hate that the trailer gave away stuff, but you do see them making out, Kane and Abby, in the trailer. Spoiler alert.
Hot.
So Cabby is happening, people.
I ship that.
Okay.
I ship Cabby. AJ, I know, again, I didn't realize that people actively had Reddit threads about you guys talking too much about Lost. But let's just add this one to the pile. Because I know AJ is a huge Desmond fan from Lost. A top character, if not your favorite character, I believe, if I'm getting that right. What's your take on Kane? Your thoughts on Henry Ian Cusack's new character? Does he shake all forms of Desmond for you? Or do you still see some Desmond when you see that character?
Oh, yeah, it's hard. It's very hard to separate the Desmond from it. But I mean, I think, at least he's he's not a loner in this. I mean, he does tend to take the bull by the horns in a way that Desmond was a lot more passive. So it's a different character, but you can't, you know, just like any of the lost actors, whatever I see them in now, I still refer to them as their lost character name. So, you know, Kane is slowly becoming Kane first, and, you know, Desmond is slipping away, but it's really hard to divorce yourself from Desmond. It really is, brother.
It really is. Joe, this is a question from Albert Vargas, who says, what are the long-term effects for Clark losing Finn in the way she did? I don't know how much you can get into it based on what you've seen, or if you could just kind of talk about it generally, but Clark made this really gigantic move at the end of season two to, you know, choose her people over the mountain people, and that's something that she's really, really having to live down. How much do you think the ghost of Finn is still with her, or do you think that there's just a, you know, an actual mountain of atrocities that are under her belt now that she's more focused on?
I think that in addition to the mountain, and particularly the children that she had to kill in order to save everyone, I believe that the Finn's blood leaves a visible stain on her hands, and it will be ongoing. Not just for her, but for Raven. And I think that he will never be forgotten. He may not be addressed, but it is a given because of both of their relationship with Finn and what has happened since, and the decisions that Clark's had to make that really started with Finn and just spiraled from there. So I think in that sense, his death was important, and it will never be forgotten.
AJ, do you got a take?
I think, you know, we have had two seasons, and it seems like that's a long time. But in terms of time on the show, it really is not a lot of time. These seasons don't take up a whole lot of their lives. So it's not only something that she did in the middle of season two. It's like it's almost like she did it yesterday. So I just don't think that anyone has really had time to decompress and realize what they've just been through. Since they hit the ground, they've been at war. And that's why this time jump is so great, I think, because it really has left these characters alone with their thoughts and trying to come to terms with everything that has happened to them since they left the Ark. And for someone like Clark, she's doing it on her own. She's left her support group and is kind of, you know, went on her little walkabout. I'm sure that's weighing on her mind. She doesn't have anyone to bounce these things off of, at least certainly not anyone who she knew beforehand. I mean, that's why I'm so concerned about Jasper, because Jasper is with the people that he thought he could trust. And every time he sees Monty, he's going to, in his head, say, what did you do? What did you do? What did you do? Because, you know, his girlfriend is gone and she's not coming back. And I think he's not going to be able to come to terms with that. And there's going to be little reminders and little places at Camp Jaha that people are going to look over there and see the thing that Finn did. He stood over there once, and Octavia Berry's over there. And, like, you know, there's going to be all these things that are going to remind them of everything that they've lost. And I think that's going to be something that is going to be very prevalent, at least early on, until we get some new action in season three.
This is a question from Molly Jackson. After seeing the season three trailer, what do you predict will happen between Bellamy and Octavia this season? There was a big moment in the trailer, maybe I'm misremembering it, that seemed really kind of violent between these two. Am I getting that right?
Yes. So you basically see Octavia beating the crap out of Bellamy. We don't know the context, but she says, "You're dead to me," which is shocking to see.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, like, anyone who's going to get in Octavia's way at this point is just going to get their ass handed to
her.
Because she's so hardcore. We haven't really talked about Octavia at all. What are your takes on Octavia? I love Octavia.
Oh, my God. The character development from season one and the pilot to the end of two. I just, you know, the visual of her, it's probably my favorite, you know, photo of all time, is her sliding on her knees, sword out, killing two guys at once in Mount Weather, like. And the fact that she says, you know, she doesn't have a home. She doesn't belong at Jaha. She doesn't belong with the tree people. She's pretty much the most active lost soul you could possibly be.
Yeah. What do you think of Octavia, AJ?
You know, she is the one person in season one who was trying to fit in, to try and become one with the grounders and accepting of this new way of life. I mean, and you can't blame her from, you know, she had to hide under a bed behind, you know, worried to be found or else she just should be floated into space. So, you know, she really couldn't live when she was on the Ark. This is her chance to live and explore. And she was so accepting of the grounder culture, and has embraced it. And, you know, to me, seeing her and Bellamy at odds, I mean, think to yourself, what could possibly cause her to turn against her brother, the one person who protected her? I mean, you would think it has to involve Lincoln in some way, and something that maybe Bellamy did that hurt Lincoln. And if that's the case, you know, all bets are off, because, you know, she's probably going to side with Lincoln over anyone else on the planet right now.
And think about this, Bellamy is her only family. So Whatever leads up to this, obviously the shit hits the fan, pardon my French. And
no, go for it. I love your French.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a horrible accent. Opposite to my day job.
That
was not an accent. I could try it. I'm going to insult people.
It sounded like French Elvis.
I know. See? I'm much better doing like other accents. We'll stick to those for another time.
Desmond, is that you?
What, brother? See, wow, tangent. Okay, yes, Octavia, Bellamy, for them to get to that position, I don't know the circumstances, but I cannot wait to see it, because you assume going along, you know, Abby and Clark don't get along terrifically, and obviously they're separated now, but Bellamy and Octavia are supposed to be it. They're supposed to be the siblings, the strong family relationship. To see that crack is sort of surprising.
Well, I mean, and the last time, AJ, you just brought it up, but the last time that they really had some sort of cataclysmic throwdown was over Lincoln. I could see something Lincoln related driving a wedge between them.
Yeah, although I will say that when I saw the trailer, I think because it's in the trailer, and I think a lot of the trailer is there to give you a complete misdirect. And to me, I think that a lot of what's going on with Bellamy is not what it seems. So my take of that is that whatever it is that Octavia is mad at, Bellamy's probably not in the wrong, but he can't tell her what is actually going on. So I think this is probably going to be one of those things where he's got to keep a secret from her. And because of that, there's this rift. And so I don't necessarily think that this is something that is permanent. It might be, but I think it could be something that could be overcome. I don't know necessarily that we're seeing the situation from the right point of view just yet.
I have a few Bellamy questions for you guys. And I want to start with number one. How many Halloween costumes were there this year of Bellamy in Mount Weather security guard mode that you saw?
I saw quite a few on Twitter. Obviously, I think there are more grounder outfits just because the girls doing the makeup is easier than maybe putting together. But I've seen some custom Bellamy Pop Funkos where he's wearing his little adorable Mount Weather hat.
Incredible.
But I'm very fond of that look because that was his John McClane, you know, guns blazing, coming through the roof moment. So I love that, Bellamy.
Yeah, well, that whole thing was terrific. And like, if you weren't on Team Bellamy at that point, how could you not be after that? And I don't know how much I want to condemn the writing of the show or just like worship at the altar of Bellamy for this. But the fact that he was undercover for like days without anyone catching wind of like, hey, maybe we've got a rogue security guard on the loose here. That one guy hasn't reported for duty for a while, and I don't think I recognize that guy wearing that security uniform. The fact that he got through like a week at Mount Weather undetected is either a little shoddy on the writing, which I'll forgive, I'm totally fine with, or it's just a testament to how badass Bellamy is.
Okay.
And, you could slice it either way and I'll be happy.
Suspension of disbelief munch. You're talking about two women who took down a giant gorilla and a two-headed deer, and that's what bothers you?
Yes. Yeah.
Fair enough.
It is. It is.
I rest
absolutely
my case.
Yeah. It doesn't bother me that much. I just thought it was really funny.
I know. There's very little nitpick, so it's fun.
There's not a ton. Certainly, I think, you know, I have some issues with the first batch of episodes, and it sounds like some people do. It gets to a certain point where I'm really happy to just be along for the ride. And the Bellamy thing, I was just cracking up about that as I was watching. I was like, really? No one has put this together?
You know, he looks kind of small for a stormtrooper.
Exactly. Very much that. We had a question from Jeremy Barton who said, who is the most bad badass character on the show. Certainly could make an argument for someone like Bellamy. What do you guys think? AJ, who's the most badass character on the show for you? Just full stop badass.
All of them?
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to choose.
It's really hard to choose. I mean, you know what? The most badass character on the show is Indra. Indra gets my vote as the most badass character.
Yes!
Planted my flag there. She is fantastic. She is loyal to a fault, but she is willing to see the other side by taking Octavia in and training her, but yet you turn on her and she's going to cut you. I love Adina Porter and her portrayal of Indra. I can't wait to see more of her. Josh, we saw her very briefly in The Leftovers. She was in the council that Meg went to visit in terms of the Guilty Remnant. She was one of the people there. I don't know if you remember that, but she's a fantastic actress, and I just love her portrayal of Indra. I want more Indra in season three.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that. But of course, I remember her from True Blood as Tara's mom in True Blood, and just always kind of, you know, being on the verge of losing her mind on that show. So when she popped up here as just like such a hardcore warrior, I was shocked. I was shocked to see that actress playing that character. But yeah, she's incredible.
I think that I would say I have two answers. Seasons one and two, well, especially leading into two, is Octavia Blake for sure. Especially given her upbringing for 16 years under a floor and then transforming into this unbelievably talented warrior. And Marie does most of all of her own stunts, and she's an incredible athlete, so it's great to watch. I will say season three, I've hinted at this on Twitter, it is a spoiler-free statement, but it is not hyperbole when I say that the fiercest, most badass scene I have ever seen on The 100 and potentially on any show in many, many years takes place in the first four episodes with Commander Lexa. It is jaw-dropping. It rivals, if not is better, than an episode of Game of Thrones.
Wow. Chew on that, everybody. got some sweet Lexa action coming your way. That's awesome. As a huge Lexa fan, I'm obviously very pumped up to hear that. Just tangentially, we had another question from Albert who said, on a scale of 1 to 100, how awesome is Lexa? And I think it breaks the chart, so we don't even really need to answer that.
I would say 108, and if you're a Lost fan, you understand.
108, yeah. I think somewhere in that neighborhood would be good. No, I'm excited about that. That's great. We have another question. I think this is an interesting one. I'm very curious to get your takes on this. Why didn't this show, this is from Matthew Blimes, why didn't this show get more critical recognition when it came to award season and end of year lists? I have a little bit of a theory about this, but I'd like to hear your takes, if AJ or Joe, if either of you guys have a particularly strong take as to why you think maybe The 100 isn't spoken of in that regard as often as some other shows you might hear about.
AJ?
Well, it's on the CW. I mean, that's just fact. It, you know, HBO is going to get most of the love, and a show from the CW, it just, voters aren't going to give it the time to even consider it. I think that's part of it. And it's also, it's a sci-fi show. At its core, there's a lot of sci-fi, and sci-fi shows don't get the respect either. I mean, you guys watch Fringe. I mean, Jon Noble deserved all the Emmys for that. He didn't even get nominated. So when you're on a show like this, in this genre, on this network, it's not going to get noticed. And if it's not going to get noticed, it's certainly not going to compete for awards, even if it deserves it.
I think a big piece of it too is, and I think that the CW thing, I absolutely hear that. I think that that is starting to chip away, and I think it's great. I mean, you've got shows like Flash and Arrow, which are just spectacular shows, but you're starting to see some awards love for some of these shows. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend got a Golden Globe for the lead actor. Jane the Virgin has gotten accolades too. So I feel like that stigma, I think that you have to, it might always exist to some degree, but I think that the CW is putting out some really quality shows. And I think it's unfortunate that reputation definitely does exist. I think that, you know, we've even talked about, there was like a CW-ness to the first episode of The 100. And I think that, you know, there's something to that, but I think that it's also not such a negative necessarily. And I hope that that starts to fade away. But for me, I think one of the bigger reasons why it's not, you know, forgetting awards, but on end of year lists and being talked about a lot, is I think the Netflix thing. You know, it took a long time for season two to get on Netflix. I would have watched The 100, you know, months and months and months ago if it had been there, but only season one was on there and I wanted to watch the whole thing. But I think now that season two is on there, Joe, I know that you've noticed this, that a lot of TV critics and such have been binging it recently and are getting other people to binge it. And I think that now that it's easy to consume, I think that you're hearing about The 100 a lot more. And I think that that can only be a very good thing as season three is just around the corner.
Oh, absolutely. The buzz is real. I mean, you know, the CW president, Mark Pedowitz, said earlier in the year at Upfronts, I believe it was May in New York, that they wanted to postpone The 100 season three until winter rather than have it come out in fall, you know, let it marinate, give them more time to write the entire season and film it and give them more leeway. And I think, you know, he also said he wanted the show to potentially have what he coined the Breaking Bad moment, which is the buzz grows between seasons when it's on Netflix. And I think that they did achieve that to a certain degree. The hype is real. Most respected journalists from Mo Ryan to Tim Goodman, I mean, and across the board are just on board with this show and helping promote it and love it so much that they're talking about it. And then other, you know, it does have a very strong influence on social media when someone you trust in their opinion, you respect them as a human being, talks about a show like this. I think the buzz is real and it's going to continue. And listen, if more people tune into season three, they will absolutely be satisfied and also very impressed with the differences, the changes, and also, you know, paying great service and detail attention to everything they've already set into place. You're not going to be disappointed. I hope that more people tune into season three because it's worth it and we need a season four.
Yeah, I think also one of the things you have to realize is when it's on the air is going to be difficult. We have a nice window here as fans of The 100 where it's going to be on, you know, Thursdays at 9. And that's great for the first three episodes or so. And then Shonda Knight comes back. And it's going to be really difficult to compete with Shonda Knight. So, but if you can, if the ratings can be there for the first few episodes and it doesn't take too much of a hit once the, you know, you got your scandal and How to Get Away with Murder coming back, I think then people start to take notice if it can compete with that. It's got a head start and that's great because if they were both premiering on the same night, it would be very difficult.
Totally, totally. A couple more questions. This one is from Geek Furious, who tweeted at us earlier today, who said, for someone who can't make it out of the pilot episode, where should I start so it doesn't suck? Which is a very harsh, harsh assessment. But, you know, not to go down like, not to be that harsh, but I was feeling similarly with the first episode or two, where I was just like, I don't know that I'm feeling this yet. You would say, based on what you guys have heard and maybe what you felt, that episode three is a hook. That's a hook for a lot of people.
I believe so. Or you could, you know, if you don't believe that, I know it didn't hook you and it kind of made you angry, maybe have them go to Unity Day.
Right. Well, I feel like, can you skip to that point? I don't think that you can.
That's like skimming through Lost. You just can't.
Yeah, I think that you, I think what I would say is you have to watch them all. Get to episode three. If you're not feeling the show by episode three, apparently you're in a fairly lonely camp that's occupied by myself and Joe's mother. Me and Joe's mom are in that camp. But having survived through that, and it's asking a lot, if you get to Unity Day, if you get to episode 9 of season 1 and you finish that episode and you're not feeling the hunch, then the hunch is not for you, I think. I think that, you know, a lot of what I was feeling about this show originally was it felt like it was actively trying to be some sort of hybrid of Lost and Battlestar Galactica. And as somebody who really loves both of those shows so, so much, I kind of puffed up my chest and stuck up my nose like, all right, well then show me what you got. Show me that you're really worthy of being a successor to one of these shows or both of these shows. And I feel like Unity Day for me is the first real, absolutely, like, this is, you know, this episode stands shoulder to shoulder with the best of both of those shows. So if you get to Unity Day and you don't like that episode, then you should probably just tap out.
Breach.
Yeah, and I think just there's a lot of stuff, Josh, I just want to say that there are a lot of people out there whose opinions, if you trust them and they like the show, then I think you should be willing to put in the work for at least a couple of episodes. I mean, I finally bit the bullet on Game of Thrones. I don't know why I was resisting, but I did. And quite frankly, I thought the pilot episode was not very good. But I won't say I felt as strongly as this person did towards The 100, but I didn't really like the pilot episode. I thought it was really slow and draggy, and I was like, what's the big deal? But because I know how big Game of Thrones has gotten and how many people are in, I said, well, let me push through it. And it's, I finished season one in like 2 days, and I'm into it now.
So I just think just push through it. If you trust people's opinions on the show, I think sometimes pilots are just draggy. It is what it is, but you kind of need to see it to set the groundwork for everything that's going to come.
The grounder work.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think, and it was really helpful for me to actually, like, cause I was so mad about the Wells thing. I can't even tell you, I can't do justice to how angry I was. But I took time from that episode and from the couple episodes afterwards that I'd seen. I think I ended, my first run of the show with Lincoln in custody. That was the last thing that I had seen. And I was just like, I needed a break. And then I came back, you know, a few weeks, a couple months later, and just plowed through it in a week. And so sometimes time can heal those wounds. But you're running out of time if you want to be caught up in time for season three. I totally think a binge at this point is still doable if you clear your afternoons and evenings. But if not, DVR the first episode of season three. You're not going to want to miss it. And then go spend this next upcoming weekend watching The Hunch. I don't think that you'll regret it. So let's start wrapping up here. I want to know what you guys have planned for season three of The Hunch, what you guys are planning to do on the dropship, what's in the near future, and how do you guys plan on covering the season as it's rolling out?
Well, our podcast, as you know, is called The Dropship, The 100 Podcast, or maybe we should call it The Hunch, just because you do. We aim to, like you, we have, you know, jobs and lives, and so we're aiming to record a new podcast on the Friday morning after new episodes Thursday. You know, that's with a big, like, asterisk of, you know, there are going to be times that we're traveling or busy and can't, and so it takes as long as it takes, according to Alexa. So that is our plan. To record a podcast. My weekly in-depth analysis will be posted live on Thursday night at 10 p.m. Pacific. Let me just say when I get screeners. When I don't, it will be posted probably Friday or Saturday because there's no way. I'm not a young kid anymore. Like with Lost, I can't stay up all night and write. I just can't. But AJ and I have some interviews planned. We are trying to hook up with the 100 showrunner Jason Rothenberg, but as you know, he's filming the finale right now, so he's a tad busy. And so we may get him briefly before 301 or briefly after. We'll take him when we can get him. I'm working with some of the other writers to line them up to talk about their episodes after they air. And I am also talking with Richard Harmon, who plays Murphy, about appearing on the podcast. So we're very excited about that.
Nice. I hope that he's not drunk and watching movies before.
he's the sweetest guy. He's nothing like Murphy.
Uh-huh. So your lives will be safe.
Yes.
Good. All right. So let's start wrapping up by, you know, if you guys have any final sign-offs, where can people find The Dropship? Any final thoughts about The Hunch going into season three? I'll start with you, AJ.
The Dropship, you can find it on iTunes, certainly, and scifimafia.com. Joe posts the links there as well. Joe, you got a Tumblr page as well. I think you post the links also. You can also find us on Twitter at AJ Mass. Joe is at JoePinionated. You can talk to us there. I'm just looking forward to season three, really, Josh. I think this show is one of the best out there, and the sky's the limit, or maybe the ground's the limit at this point.
The ground's the limit.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm telling you, there's going to be cars this season. Cars were in the trailer. I'm excited about that, and I'm telling you, predictions by the end of the season, we see a freaking plane.
Oh, man.
Dude.
That'd be awesome. We've already seen drones, so we're close.
True.
I'm telling you, this season ends with a plane. Not a plane crash. This isn't Lost. I'm going to stop talking about Lost, but plane.
That's awesome. Joe, any final thoughts before we sign out here?
I would just like to take this opportunity to thank both of you, really, for the opportunity to podcast about Lost first and now The 100, because, you know, without you guys, I would still be just writing, which is great and fulfilling, and I love it, but this is really, really fun and satisfying for me, and it's a rewarding experience. So I appreciate both of you for that aspect, and I also need to extend a note of gratitude to the fans. I mean, honestly, since I quickly became part of the 100 fan community, my Twitter followers have almost doubled, and the readership has gone up on Sci-Fi Mafia, and I think it's affecting the dropship ratings on iTunes, which is terrific. And everyone, like 99% of the feedback has been constructive and or positive on all arenas and all social media. So I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to be a part of the fandom and to be contributing to the conversation and analyze the show.
Yeah, it's great. I love it when Jo's fired up. She's really fired up about the show, and when she is, the world's a better place.
Aww.
And I'm very pumped up to be officially on board with the Hunge, which we'll use as our hashtag for this episode.
The Hunge. How do you spell the Hunge?
It's H-U-N-D-G-E, the Hunge. Tweet that hashtag our way to at AJ Mass, at JoePinionated, and I am at Round Howard, like Ron Howard, but rounder. Not grounder. We're not grounders here on Post Show Recaps, but we do broadcast from a spaceship. Don't miss season 3. It's just around the corner on the CW on January 21st. Jo and AJ, thanks so much for coming on here, and may we meet again.
Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot, Josh. We appreciate it.